Welcome to episode 77 of the Vancouver Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Drew Ogrizek. This week, we have special guests Charles Crampeau, CTO of Coho, Scott Belware, co-creator of the Eventide Project, Adam Dimitrik, CEO of Adapt Tech Solutions, and Nathan Ladd, co-creator of the Eventide Project, all joining us to talk monoliths versus microservices. Scott, maybe you can start us off. In your words, what is a monolith?
It's usually the result, unintended result of years of development using a framework that has tendencies to invite the outcome of a monolith into an application's architecture. It really is typified by having everything in one place. That's usually the advantage that people are looking for early on in the process. The productivity advantage early in, you know, let's say a startup's development or a new project's development, having everything in one place, allowing the developers to, you know, see everything in one place, just open it all up in one editor view and work with it. The architectural implications of it are that once this is done, once we have something like this, and once we use tooling that invites this kind of thing or thinking that invites this kind of thing, it becomes very, very difficult to change from that monolith to something that isn't monolithic. Right now, the industry is trying to en masse. You know, everyone's trying to do this now. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it wasn't everyone that wanted to pull this off, but now everybody wants to use a service architecture, what with the popularization of the microservices word. Brand.
Thoughts, Charles?
Think of when people start off, you know, doing software engineering. You might not have these terms in your head. And like some of these like labels like microservices are rather new terms. At least I've only heard them recently. What people often build first is a monolith, right? Like you start building some kind of software. Often you split between front end and back end, although that wasn't so true in the past, but you have that kind of split and you start adding features and adding features and adding features. And all of a sudden you have this giant thing, right? And you often label that a monolith. The complexity comes about because a lot of times different pieces within the system are very tightly coupled. And as time goes on, it gets much, much harder to one, understand the whole system, and two, to be able to make changes, because change in one place could break things in other places. There's also coordination costs. As you put more people in the company, if you have something where there's a lot of coupling between different parts of the system, it gets very hard for those people to coordinate, right? And one good way to coordinate when there's a lot of people is not to have to coordinate at all. If you can break the system up into like separate services, and whether you call them microservices or something else, it makes it so you don't step on each other's toes and you don't have all the problems you necessarily have. So sometimes like you make the decision to go into a service-oriented architecture as a social, dealing with a social issue, right? You have too many people to work together on one team. You got to split up. How do you coordinate?
Couldn't you kind of easily deal with those same issues by with modularity in a monolith?
Yep. Yes, you could. Think of what people in practice mean by a service, right? Like nowadays, a lot of people, what they mean is, okay, I'll have something that's provides like an HTTP-based API, right? And that's what people think is a service. But like, that's not necessarily a service, right? You could have something, you know, straight in your code, right? Like you can have this kind of division within the code, and like whether you call that like a modular monolith or you know, microservices, service oriented architecture is somewhat semantics. Like what do you call these things, right? But having this decoupling, having this separation, having the where it's kind of independent, like if you can do that, lets you kind of scale as an organization and sometimes also the software.
Adam?
Yeah, monolith is what is being referred to as software where coupling and cohesion have been managed incorrectly. So the symptom that I look for is a large multi-column table in a database, usually is a low-hanging fruit to look for, such as a product table with a ton of columns for different concerns that everyone knows don't belong together, but just for convenience and the adage of saving space or not complicating things, you have them sitting together because the product table has everything that anyone needs to know about a product. And that tends to put things that don't belong together into one table. And that gives other architectural concerns a problem, such as transactional scope, that when you're locking that row for an update or something. Other services can't get at it, but that is still a very superficial analysis. There's deeper concerns about keeping architectures clean.
And what are your thoughts there, Nathan?
Monoliths are characterized by strong dependencies between the different data elements, the different database tables, foreign key relationships, associations. Imagine you've just got a single class that is messy, right? Maybe it's 1,000 lines of code with all these methods and whatnot. So let's say you want to replace that class with another, a better class or a set of classes that work better. You know, we kind of understand better, I think, what we need to do. We need to build a new thing that has the same sort of interface that does all the same thing as the old one, right? Or we have to, if we want to introduce a breaking change as part of our improvement, then we've got to go to every call site and adjust accordingly because we made a breaking change to the interface. That's painful enough when you're looking at a single class, you know, that's maybe got 1,000 lines of code. When you're looking at a monolith that your organization spent years, you know, had a team of people spending years getting it into the state that it's in, you had not even beyond the dev team, you had requests by your sales associates or your product management team that needed features for that one customer. You've accumulated all these use cases over the years. So I think that a lot of teams tend to underestimate how much they have to keep working in the monolith to keep all of your customers happy. They don't think about all those elaborate user interfaces that you've stood up that need that one database table to be just so. Otherwise, that interface won't work.
Is there a sort of reasonable way or a sane way, like going back to the example of a single class, because I think that's something we can kind of hold in our head, 1,000 lines long and that has, you know, hundreds of methods that its interface may be being used. Is there a way to know what depends on that and its methods being exposed and doing certain things?
There is a way to know, and that is note-taking. So you can know it by hand, right? So you can go through all of your user interfaces and make note of what data are they, what part of your data model are those user interfaces coupled to? And that gives you a starting point to make you realize how much functionality you have to preserve in the new system. And it also gives you an opportunity to say, hey, we don't need that anymore. So you can decommission, you know, parts of your user interface today and eliminate chunks of work down the road just by sort of auditing.
Now, I guess like with most things, the level of confidence that you'd have with knowing that would be based a lot on the amount of time that you spent into it, then probably with diminishing returns over time.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, whether you're using a statically typed language to program and that gives you all sorts of automatic inferencing tools or not, at this level, you're never able to use a tool to kind of extract or mine all this information for you, which means you're also susceptible to human error. So if you do one pass through everything, you're going to get a good amount of data from it. You do a second pass, you might get a little bit more, and you might correct some misunderstandings you had the first time. Mm-hmm. This kind of thing is very grueling work, and it's very, very easy to get sloppy with it if you're not careful. Nobody likes punching through UI and taking notes. Like, it used to be very common that every programmer would keep a notebook next to their computer, and they would just meticulously write notes. I think that kind of thing is a good starting point, because when you think about what you want to do is substitute this entire gigantic organism that you've built over a couple years for something new, and you've got to know what that organism does. And usually teams have kind of lulled themselves, teams that are really excited about microservices have lulled themselves into thinking, well, it's basically just doing, you know, our whole monolith is just basically doing back of house inventory processing. So that's what we need as a service. And that kind of perspective neglects all the hidden contracts that your user interfaces have with that monolith.
So what does service-oriented architecture bring to that?
Service-oriented architecture kind of like splits that up a bit. You have just like separations that don't have any tight coupling. And like you can like debate over like, what does that mean? Like, do you share the same database or maybe not? There's costs like between doing either thing. And like, that's true of a lot of software engineering. If you have a separate database, then you can't do stuff like do queries across like many, many tables throughout your system. It becomes very challenging to do that kind of stuff. But it's separate, right? Like, and you don't have that tight coupling, and you know, maybe two engineers can come in and like just own the system totally and make changes without having to worry about like stepping on anyone else's toes, right? And then microservices seems to be a rather new thing. My impression, like, I mean, like, you can get into like, what do you mean by microservice? Should adding two numbers be a microservice? Like to me, that's kind of like silly. Like, it doesn't, I wouldn't want to do it that way. But my impression is that typically when someone says microservice, they mean really the separate database, separate, like this is a separate project and it just happens to communicate. There are ways you can kind of go wrong with this type of stuff. Like, for example, if I have a service and then it's refers to other services over the network, right? And then you've got this kind of complexity that you've built. You've got like this, all these separate systems. It's really one system with that, like that much coupling, right? Because if you don't separate the coupling, then like you're not getting the advantages of this kind of service-oriented architecture.
I've heard this said, and I thought it was pretty interesting. A difference between SOA and microservices would be smart pipes, dumb services versus smart services, dumb pipes.
Yeah, it sounds like a good definitional thing. Like in a lot of terms, like you have the names, and where you map the names to the concepts is somewhat arbitrary. But if you pick one and everyone agrees on it, sure, it makes sense. But yeah, with a lot of engineering stuff, there's trade-offs, and neither one is good or bad. And some of it's going to depend on the experience of the software developer doing this stuff, right? Like if you're just starting off, you might have not gone through the pain that would cause you to want to separate this stuff out kind of like ahead of time. And like you build something and evolves into monolith and it's like, oh crap, this is horrible. Like it's hard to change anything and I need to start like kind of separating. And then that's tough too, right? And as you get more experienced, you might have more foresight. So, okay, last four times I did this, there was a lot of pain after 2 years. So I'm just going to think ahead and already start to like modularize this so that it makes the pain I'll have in the future, you know, I won't have that pain, or it'll make it easier to deal with.
So what's a good place to start? Let's say you have a monolith. It's been in production for X years. You have, you know, N number of customers using it. And when/why would you ever even think of microservices?
I think the case for microservices is a couple things. Number one, you end up, if you know you're going to end up with 10 million lines of code, there's only so much control that a human organization can have over that much code. Mm-hmm. And I think that services, autonomous services that are operated and maintained independently, that are very loosely coupled, offers you a way to say, I don't need to build a 10 million line of code thing that's good. I only need to build things that are 10,000 line or whatever the number is. I can build smaller things that are good. It's a lot easier for us to control something that's smaller, right?
Sure, but I mean, that sounds quite reasonable for a starting point or when you have some sort of conceptual understanding of where to draw the seams, but doesn't that just lead to distributed monoliths?
Well, I think that the methodology you employ and the conceptualization you have of microservices is going to determine whether you end up with a distributed monolith.
Uh-huh. So kind of how well you understand the problems that you're solving.
Yeah, definitely. I've seen a lot of teams not really understand what the monolith does. And who all is depending on it. They don't even picture in their minds the people out there in the world using the software and everything that they're using it for when they say confidently, yep, we're ready for microservices.
Well, I've heard some very, I think, interestingly conflicting opinions. You know, you like start with a monolith, build that out, then see where the logical seams are and start pulling those out into services. And Scott Belwer actually mentioned something that I thought was really interesting, which was I think it was something like the road to services is not through monoliths, or a monolith is not a logical progression toward microservices.
Yeah. So I think what we characterize monoliths with is one big bag of data with a whole bunch of software on top of it.
So, Sorry, I just wanted to add to that because I pulled up microservices.io, which you may be familiar with. I know there's a lot of information about microservices, and under the title "Where to Start," it literally says this: a good starting point is the monolithic architecture pattern, which is the traditional architecture style that is still a good choice for many applications. And this is with regards to where do we go? How do we get to microservices?
Yeah, I think if you every monolith I've seen, and that's really what I can speak to, and I've seen quite a few of them. Every monolith I've seen, if you just take the code and the boundaries as they're structured inside the monolith and the data dependencies, and you just start taking that code and moving it out to a service, you're going to end up with communication patterns between your services that sort of violate the autonomy of those services because they've never had to exist in an environment where they're bounded locally. Monoliths are characterized by strong dependencies between the different data elements, the different database tables, foreign key relationships, associations. And I think that that sounds really good in theory, right? I would like that to be the case, right? What microservices.io is saying. However, I have never seen a monolith that was ready to be ready to be converted into services.
So how would you describe or characterize microservices?
Right. So microservices are at the opposite end of the spectrum, which should imply that there is no easy path or migration from a monolith to a microservice. You're looking at everything in between that doesn't belong is in between monolith and microservice. So microservices are the polar opposite of the monolith, where you do have a small subset of data and cyclomatic complexity is down and you have one concern that you're dealing with, such as pricing for a product. So you would, in a proper microservice, you would be only storing pricing information about a product if your service is dealing with pricing. You wouldn't need the picture of the product or descriptions or other things. And you may have a product table in a whole bunch of microservices with varying overlap of data, but that's fine. The idea is that a microservice can be worked on and owned by a small team where they don't have a ton of code to deal with. They can deploy everything and they can continue to be agile in delivering what, let's say, the product pricing service is supposed to do, i.e. if something goes wrong or there's changes in the way the pictures for products are being served up, this particular team that's dealing with pricing has nothing to do with that. On the surface, it may look like you could do that in a monolith, but the sad reality is, again, the coupling rears its ugly head, and things that are supposed, what would seem to be simple changes, are no longer simple changes.
So do we see this really as the way of the future? Monolith, and then to microservices, and going forward to micro-monolith services?
This same problem that monoliths, in a startup came to exist because of constraints. Same thing can happen to an individual microservice where all of a sudden maybe your product pricing service has, because of whatever factors, has started to incorporate a bunch of non-pricing information into it and functionality. And this is where our diligence has to come in and say that we're not adding this to the pricing service. We need to make a separate service and deal with how we integrate the whole solution together. So microservices, again, just to finish the thought on microservices, don't query one another. So one of the typical problems with SOA or where microservices came from is that we looked at the technology stacks used to define what SOA is, and how do we do remote procedure call over HTTP, etc. That was initial.
So what's a problem? I think you mentioned it. What is a problem with using a technology stack to define an architectural pattern or architectural patterns?
It usually leaves behind the diligence needed to keep data separate, which is what will glue things together. For example, you could have multiple APIs for different parts of the product, such as pricing. However, if on the back end you have one database with one giant product table, these are not really services. They have the illusion of being microservices, but they're not. They have a well-organized API, but to get any work done is still going to be tricky in terms of dealing with the side effects.
So they're not, in that case, you're saying they're not services. Is that because of how much they rely on each other, or because of how many calls they have to make, or because they're coupled together to even be able to return meaningful data?
That's all right. That's what I was getting at, is microservices should be functional on their own. I think what we have in the industry right now is, as long as things are running in Docker, we're fine. But the next level of understanding for microservices is how autonomous they are. And in that comes PubSub versus querying for information. One of the key things with microservices is that they don't query one another for information. What we have is an ability to publish and get the information ahead of time into services that may depend on that information. So in the traditional example that you can see, it's kind of like light switches. If you turn off one service, do the other ones that rely on it, are they immediately offline, right? Or are they just happily going along with, maybe a little bit stale information? But that's fine. If it's within our SLAs, that's okay. Without that, we have remote procedure calls to do lookups from another service. If I turn off that service that's going to be used for that query, then I'm going to have an issue with that not being available. So again, there are ways to use technology to try and cache information for certain things, but I think that still leaves a lot to be a lot to be desired for how we want to deal with information and organizing data and behavior.
Scott?
Microservices is a brand name for services that we've always had for decades. So, service is a service is a service. Microservice is just a new name for service-oriented architecture for this decade, for a new generation of developers who maybe would be intimidated by having to go back and learn something historical. So it's basically SOA. A lot of this comment is out there. Microservices is just SOA done without the mistakes. Mm-hmm. So there's one critical aspect of how SOA has evolved over the years, because things evolve over the years. Tools are thinking. So SOA over the years has evolved such that we arrive today where we say something that we did in the past with SOA wasn't so great, so we're not going to do that anymore. And that thing was programmable message buses. So that's a smart bus, smart pipes. And in the SOA world,
so whether it's a good idea or not, I think a lot of people often identify with the tooling around those ideas or concepts. So what would be some of the tooling you might use in a smart bus or a smart...
RabbitMQ. It's basically that the bus has intelligence. So you put a message on a bus and the bus can figure out where it needs to go, like the endpoint. It can reroute or reroute itself. Or that it could decide whether or not it needs to be sent at all, or whether or not it has been sent once and therefore don't send it again, or it never arrived and therefore send. So that's intelligence built into the bus. In the microservices world, not because it's microservices, but just because our thinking has evolved, our thinking in SOA has evolved. We just sort of realized that was more problematic. It seemed like a really great idea. It's really pretty fancy and cool. It's really intellectually stimulating, but in the end, in practice, in operations, it became its own set of problems. And so now we build services that don't really have dependencies on the capabilities of the bus to get their work done. So things like idempotence, whether or not that's a familiar term, is something that has to be handled by the service implementation, not by the bus itself. And that leads to different sets of patterns, more evolved sets of patterns and techniques that we use to actually build the application or applicative logic in the services.
Now, would that be, I guess, communication tooling that might be in shared libraries across the microservice architecture?
No, they're very, very rarely is. That's kind of like with the saying, dumb pipes, smart services. It means that the services have code. The application code logic itself, which we'll call applicative logic henceforth, the applicative logic itself has some knowledge that there's messaging going on, and that the developers are no longer shielded from having to know that there's messaging going on, and that there are certain realities of messaging, i.e. dealing with idempotence, that the developers have to handle. But that's not something that can be so quickly and so easily generalized. You know, quickly and easily generalizing it, by the way, means that we're taking that logic and we're pushing it back towards the bus again. The goal is not to shield the developers anymore. Developers are going to do this kind of work, which used to be thought of as high-end work that only a small fraction of the developer population can deal with. Now, if this is going to go mainstream, developers just need to, you know, buckle down and understand this stuff. And once they do, they'll be empowered. They'll gain a new superpower. But it's not that difficult to learn, but it must be learned. And it's usually something that developers don't have a handle on. The moment a developer tries to take that and push it out of their responsibility, try to generalize it into a library, that's no difference than having a smart bus.
Okay, so if you were to give some advice or recommendations to, let's say, a CEO or sort of a non-technical lead whose CTO or technical lead has brought up the proposition of breaking out the monolith into microservices, what would that advice be?
Honestly, I think most CEOs, they don't have this kind of knowledge. They don't care. They're not going to want to become engineers necessarily, right? So, you know, the developers working on this, it's going to be up to them to make that kind of decision, right? And they're going to do the best they can a lot of times, right? They're going to have time constraints, they're going to have their own experience, and they're going to make a choice. And that choice might not be the best choice, but they're not going to know it until like 2 years later, right? And like a lot of the software engineering, it's about trade-offs. Like there's no necessarily one perfect thing. You make a choice and hopefully it's okay.
Nathan?
If I were in the CEO's shoes, I would be wanting to see a detailed plan that mitigates some common pitfalls. Number one, how are you going to reshape the underlying data model that is entangled within the monolith? How are you going to reshape it into having these isolated consistency boundaries that you can simply detach as services? That's a very technical assessment. But I think that's what you needed to sort of ask of your development team. What are you going to do about the monolith to get it ready? Because you can't extract the code from a monolith and call it a service. You can rearrange the code and the underlying data layer. You can rearrange it so that it can be detached safely, but that's a lot of work. And are you including the cost of that work in your assessment of how big of a deal, you know, how big of a level of effort is it for us to go to microservices? And that's assuming you're trying to go from monolith to microservices. Another approach is to simply build a new product and then transparently migrate your customers from the old to the new, which has its own set of pitfalls and problems.
Scott?
Watch out. Monolith is not a stop along the way towards microservices. It's not part of the evolutionary path towards microservices. They are actually, they're things that are opposite ends of the continuum that are traveling in opposite directions. So breaking out microservices, that terminology is usually a red flag for us, for my team and for my colleagues. That typically means that you're That typically is associated with an end result of a services project that is going to end up creating what we call the distributed monolith, which they haven't solved. They haven't understood what the root cause of the monolith is, and they just took the monolith and broke out, in air quotes, broke out, you know, the product service and the user service and all these services that sound like entities, because those entities in the are backed by database rows, and those database rows themselves are monolithic. And so if you don't, if you go to a microservices architecture and you're not looking at your rows and saying, well, this part of the row goes to that service, is going to be broken out to that service, you're going to be breaking up rows, not breaking out rows. You're going to be breaking up rows. It's very dangerous when you take a monolith and you end up breaking out entire rows, entire entities, and moving them into their own services, because the amount of communication that needs to happen over a network is going to reflect the amount of communication that is already in the non-distributed implementation that you already have. So you take a non-distributed implementation, simply put those things on a network. By the way, we did this all the way in the 90s and the 2000s. That's called distributed objects. It was an abject and complete and utter disastrous failure. So we get a, you know, we get a cadre, a new cohort of developers with 5 to 10 years experience who don't know that that's actually a disastrous thing to do with computers and networks and software, and they're going to recreate it, and they are recreating it. The distributed monolith is a reality, and projects are failing because of it. And that is tragic, because first of all, the monolithic project that was supposed to be magical and wonderful didn't end up so great. That cost is written off. Now we're doing a rewrite into microservices. And now we're seeing those microservices costs being written off because those created distributed monoliths instead of service architectures. And that's just, that's the end game for a development team. That, at that point, a development organization loses all of its credibility with the business, and the business is going to stop giving permission to the
So we've done a really good, I think, a really good job of scaring
that. Yep. And so, they should. No, but they should. They should be bloody, should be bloody terrified of this. This is a absolutely massive risk.
And we've done a good job of sort of painting the roadside mess. You mentioned breaking out versus breaking up rows. Could you give some more concrete examples of what that would look like?
Sure. Let's say you,
one would be better than the other.
Let's say you have a product row, and the product row has a product ID, a name, a description, a price, and the quantity in stock. So this is a bit of a naive design of a product, but you know, it's probably something that you would that your average developer would look at and say, yeah, that doesn't seem out of the ordinary. Or it doesn't seem necessarily wrong. When you break out an entity, product is an entity. Product is also a row, so entity and row interchangeable. It's an entity in an ORM, and the ORM has a row, right? Has a table, has a row behind it. So that row structure is probably going to look a lot like product ID, product name, product description, product price, product quantity. That's all in one row. That's all in one schema. When you break that out, you take that product and you move that entirely to its own service. When you break it up, you take the parts that belong together that reflect different services, like name and description are probably something that, they appear to be something that would be involved with a catalog. The price appears to be something that belongs to a price book or price optimization. And quantity in stock obviously appears to be something related to inventory. That means you don't end up with a product service. You end up with catalog. You end up with maybe. I mean, you know, I can't guess at what somebody's architecture is going to be, but you end up with in this example, a catalog service, a quantity, an inventory service, and a price book service or price optimization service. Those are separate services. That doesn't leave you with a product row, with the product row. That leaves you with product data that belongs in different services. So the product row has been broken up. The product entity has been broken up and distributed. And once you do that, you have to embrace an entirely new way of doing communications between the different working parts of your system. You can't just go and query the product, the entire product, pull it over to your code, to your system, your service.
And Adam, what advice would you have?
We have had a bunch of technical ways or specific ways of dealing with requirements and gluing technical to the non-technical side. So business, how do business requirements get translated into technical solutions, and how are these worlds that seemed very far apart, how are they better brought together? The one practice that I think everyone can gain a lot of insight from is a practice called event storming. It's a play on words for brainstorming about what the solution is supposed to be, or even used as an analytical tool for the current solution that's in play. So event storming is an exercise where technical and non-technical and all roles, including CEO and CTO, can take a look at a stream of events that happen in the business. And this answers both behavior and data structure questions underneath, but without getting into the technical jargon. So one of the things that I would highly recommend for anyone that's a CEO or looking at things from the business side is to explore how architecture and how solutions overall can be put together with the exercise of event storming. It's something that can be done in a workshop in as little as an hour or two, depending on the size of solution, to doing something with a large organization over a workshop that spans 2 days, and certainly can be revisited. Some of the benefits of that is a cohesive understanding, but also a platform for having a discussion with the traditional things that get in the way, such as proper documentation and other things. Some of this red tape is really removed, and the core of the system or the organization can be looked at quite clearly. So there's a book on it out there as well. It's by Alberto Brandolini from Italy. Don't worry, it's in English, but he's the guy that coined the term. I believe Greg Young did this earlier with strategic domain-driven design or other things. However, I think Alberto brings it home with having a very good set of guidelines of how to actually execute on this, and how to get people involved, and how to structure that. So grab a bunch of Sharpies and sticky notes, and show what your organization wants to build. And if you dive deep into event storming, I think those answers for CEOs and non-technical business facing folks will see just how close you are to the actual solution, or can be.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for being on this episode of the Vancouver Tech Podcast.
Yeah.
Thanks, Drew,
for having me.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vancouver Tech Podcast.
Check out our website, vancouvertechpodcast.ca.
Rate and subscribe on iTunes. Much appreciated.
You can follow us on Twitter, VanTechPodcast.
Feel free to leave some comments below.
You can also hit us up on the YVR Dev, the Vancouver Tech, the VanTech Slacks. I'm at James.
And I'm at Drew. Special thanks to Same Room for hooking us up with an integration that allows us to have a cross-team Slack channel, VanDevs.
Do you have a meetup that you want us to plug? Email us, show@vancouvertechpodcast.ca.
Music by A Shell in the Pit from the game Parkitect. See you at one of the meetups
around town.